Hi, welcome to The Naturalist, brought to you on Heritage Radio Network, coming from Roberta's Restaurant in downtown Bushwick. I assume it's downtown. I haven't seen too many other things around here, but I don't live here, so I don't really know. But we're brought to you by Roberta's, and today, as my partner host, Carol Butler, who's a naturalist also. I met her at the Museum of Natural History, where we worked in the Butterfly Conservancy together, and she's the author of a whole series of books that she's working on. And today we're going to talk about mating, the mating game. Now, I'm not talking about picking up a copy of The Village Voice and looking through all the ads in the back, but you know, it's sort of related to that. So Carol, can you tell me about animal mating or some interesting stuff?
Sure, I can tell you a lot.
Oh, but first tell us about your books, because okay, Everybody hasn't heard about your,
right,
your books.
I've done a series of question and answer books about animals, and the examples that I will talk about are from the books. There's a book on butterflies, and one on bees, and one on bats, and one on hummingbirds, and one on birds of prey. They're all published by Rutgers University Press. So the ones that are out already are bats and butterflies, and the rest are coming soon. I want to talk about how specific animals go about attracting a mate, but I need to begin with a little caveat in that some animals don't even bother with any kind of courtship ritual. For example, in some species of bats, they'll be hibernating, and the male will awaken and will just mate at random with a hibernating female. In the Heliconius butterfly, the postman, it's a Heliconius, a long-winged butterfly called the postman, which we have in the conservatory.
Yes, it's a lovely little butterfly.
Right. The males emerge first from the pupa, and so they are ready to mate as soon as a female emerges, and they engage in what is called pre-copulatory mate guarding.
Whoa.
I have to warn you, I like all these terms.
That's pretty fancy.
Yeah.
Now, how do they know who's in that chrysalis?
Well, it's a good question. They can detect a female when she's near the end of her pupal stage because she releases sex-specific volatile compounds at that point, and the male can detect them and knows that there's a female in that particular pupa ready to come out. And so he sits on that pupa, and he may even tear a hole in its wall so that he can mate with the female even before she is completely emerged, and certainly before she can fly or have anything to say about it.
Yeah, you think he needs some sex therapy? He's hot to trot even before she gets out.
Well, it's interesting. When there's something like this, you always have to ask, what is the evolutionary significance of it? Here, the female is contributing to this. She's contributing by giving off a signal that tells the male that she's ready to mate. So there must be some advantage for the female in doing that, although I don't really see it. I think it's sort of better to have a choice.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that I thought of while you were talking about this is that the adult butterflies have such a short lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
You think that could...
It could be a reason.
That could be an evolutionary advantage to immediately start copulating.
Right.
And not even wait for a choice.
It could very well be. Maybe that they're in a harsh climate and their life is very fragile because of the conditions that they emerge into. And they're certainly very small. Some males, after mating with the female, plug her genital opening with a waxy plug so that it's impossible for her to mate again. We'll talk more about that sort of thing. Some species of bees, these are solitary bees now, not honeybees that live in a colony, but solitary bees also do this kind of preemptive mating. So there's no courtship. The males emerge before the females. In this case, the female bee pupates inside a nest. Let's say she digs a little hole in the ground and pupates inside there, lays her eggs in there, rather, and the eggs come out, and she leaves food for the caterpillars, and then they pupate. And when she comes out of the pupal case, she comes out of the nest, the male is waiting for her and mates with her right then and there.
Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us about what the word pupate is, briefly.
Sure.
Because a lot of people get confused with this life stages of these Lepidopteras.
Sure. It's in complete metamorphosis is what we're talking about, where the female lays an egg. It matures over a relatively short period of time, and then a caterpillar or larvae emerges from the egg, and that eats a lot and keeps growing, and finally and sheds its skin. It has an exoskeleton, which is a hard exterior skeleton. As it grows, it fills up the skin, and then the skin cracks open and sheds, and there's a softer skin. If you think of a snake shedding, everybody knows about that, or a crab shell has an exoskeleton. Snakes don't have an exoskeleton, but they do shed as they outgrow the skin. And butterflies go through maybe 4 instars, which is the different stages of the caterpillar, and then the final shedding of the skin reveals the pupa underneath, which is a stage in which they're completely enclosed. They don't eat, and they just metamorphose from a caterpillar. They completely reorganize their molecular structure. They discard some of the extra legs that they don't need, and after a relatively short period of time, they break out of that pupa, and out comes a butterfly.
Okay.
And that's we see that in the conservatory. That's a big moment when a butterfly comes out of the pupa.
So that's the chrysalis, right. Is that little thing. And
right.
With moths, it's called a cocoon, right?
Well, no, cocoon is a like an extra casing that
over
a moth makes, and they pupate inside that.
Right. Okay, good.
Okay, so the butterfly pupa that I described, butterfly's pupa hangs on a tree or is relatively exposed, which is why the male can sit on it, where the solitary bees pupate inside a nest. Okay. So now we can talk about attracting a mate, since we got that out of the way. I guess since we're talking about butterflies, I'll talk about butterflies first. Male butterflies usually search for females with whom to mate, and they can identify a female and a species that's appropriate for them with whom to mate because they have ultraviolet wing patterns that they can identify that we can't see, of course, but they have ultraviolet vision, so they can see the wing patterns just as they can see the patterns on the flowers, so they can go right to the center of the flower to get the nectar. Sometimes a male is mistakenly approached by another male, and usually they just flutter their wings vigorously to warn the approaching male to back off, although sometimes they interact competitively. We see that once in a while where they kind of zoom around each other till one gets the idea. Different species have different mating rituals. Some courting males engage in courtship dances, flying above or behind females, fluttering their wings very rapidly. And this goes on for a long time. If the female is unwilling to mate with a particular male, sometimes she's already mated or if she doesn't like his looks, she can fly away. She flies in a spiral path sometimes. And sometimes the female will just sit with her abdomen held in such a way that it's impossible for the male to approach her. And eventually the male will get the idea and will fly away. Some males are territorial. They patrol a certain area on the lookout for suitable females, and they dart threateningly at other male butterflies that approach the territory. And some even make sounds, which is a whole interesting area. We know that there's been research with moths that make sound. They make kind of high-pitched squeaks and clicks, which they use to attract mates. And they also, the research that I've seen is where they have studied moths and predatory bats.
Also. Make sounds.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
bats we know make a lot of
right,
noises.
But the moths make clicks. The toxic moths make a certain click, and the bats are alert to that, and they hear that click, and they know that moth is toxic, and they stay away from it.
Okay, so I think we'll stop for a second,
yeah.
And you left us hanging also because we don't
right.
know some of the other things that you're going to cover. And we'll be back in a minute or two. This is the Heritage Radio Network, the naturalist Bernie Wise and Carol Butler, co-hosts today. And we're being brought to you from Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick. Hi, here we are back from a short break, and we were just about to talk about bees, and Carol mentioned solitary bees as opposed to bees that live in hives, and I think a lot of them live in the ground, these solitary bees.
Yes, that's right.
And they make a nest, and that's, I think, how we left it with the female in the nest, I think.
Right.
But
did you want to mention our sponsor before we get started?
Oh, so yes. That's right. We have a new sponsor in this segment, and it's Fairway Markets. And I think the closest Fairway Market to Bushwick is in Red Hook, Brooklyn, which is a terrific store. I once stopped off there with a hop-on, hop-off ferry. I used to stop there. It was a terrific place. And I personally shop at the one in Manhattan. So let's get back to the bees.
Okay. I want to talk about honeybees because their mating behavior is probably the most interesting of any. The queen honeybees, honeybees live in a colony, a big colony, and the only bee that mates in the entire colony is the queen. Although there's been some research where they have found that some of the bees in the colony were actually not the queen's offspring, but this is sort of cutting edge research. So more on that in the future. But the general rule is that only the queen mates. So when the queen is out of her pupa for a few days, she goes on what's called a mating flight. And I should say, there are males in the... I'm trying to switch from attracting a mate to mating. Okay. There are males in the colony who are, and the males are called drones, and their only function is to mate with the queen. So there are males hanging around, and a queen lives for a long time, so there's no activity for the drones. But at some point when the queen is too old or when the colony swarms and they need a new queen, there has to be some mating activity.
Mm-hmm. So are these all the males in the colony, or are there some worker bees?
No, the workers are all female.
The workers?
All the bees are female, and they're all daughters of the queen.
And they do all the work.
They do everything.
The drones hanging around waiting for their turn.
Right. They can't even sting, because the stinger is the ovipositor. The female structure from which they lay the egg. Okay. So the males have no function other than to mate with the virgin queen. Mm-hmm. So after she's been around for a couple of days, the virgin honeybee queen, takes a mating flight, and she may make two or three flights to what is called a drone congregation area. This is an area where the drones hang out, and they fly, 20, 30 feet above the ground, and they just fly around waiting for a virgin queen to come into the area. And they detect her pheromones, they sense that she's there, and then they all try to mate with her. Once they make contact with her, the mating lasts from anywhere from 1 to 5 seconds, but it's quite an experience for the drone. The drone will grasp the queen with all 6 legs and inserts it's called an endophallus in a drone language, into the queen's sting chamber. At this point, the drone becomes paralyzed, and he flips backward, and he ejaculates as a result of the pressure of the body fluid on his abdomen as it contracts when he flips backward. So you have to sort of think about that. His abdomen kind of squishes in half, and the hemolymph causes the ejaculation and propels the semen into the queen's oviduct.
So it's one shot, and that's it.
It's really that's it, because it also breaks off his endophallus.
Oh, terrific.
And he dies shortly after mating. Mm. I have never been in a drone congregation area, but I read a report from someone who'd been in one, and they said that when a queen bee is mating, there's a large number of dying drones dropping to the ground, sometimes accompanied by a noise like popcorn popping. Right?
I've heard of popcorn after sex.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Right. And this part is for Jack. The severed genitals of the drone may act as a temporary vaginal plug in the queen, which allows time for the drone's sperm to enter the queen's system and keeps other drones away from her. But, of course, she can expel the plug, and a subsequent suitor can also dislodge the plug, so that no drone is guaranteed exclusivity. The queen receives millions of sperm from this orgy. And, of course, some of the sperm die as they're passing through her system. But typically she'll retain about 6 million sperm from this mass mating. And these sperm will fertilize her eggs for the rest of her life.
That's it.
That's it. She'll never mate again. She'll just keep laying eggs and until she dies.
So it's a one-time orgy for the males, especially, because they die afterwards. And for the queen, she's, from being a virgin, she has... could have 6 million offspring.
Right, exactly.
What a lifestyle.
Right. Wow. So you may ask, what is the evolutionary advantage of mating with so many drones? This is something that has been studied, because bees are one of the animals that are very commonly artificially inseminated. And we could talk about that, but we talk about that in the book. But they use artificial insemination to create colonies that have been fathered by only one drone. They collect sperm from one drone, and then they collect sperm from several drones, or I don't know how many, but a large number of drones, mix it, and fertilize the queen with mixed semen from several drones. And then they can study a colony with one father and a colony with several fathers. And they find that when the queen has been fertilized by mixed semen, I really like this, this is very interesting, the workers in the colony can keep the temperature in the nest more stable than the genetically uniform colonies.
Uh-huh.
What the bees do is
if
the colony gets overheated, the bees fan with their wings to cool it. If they all come from the same father, they start fanning at exactly the same time. If they come from different fathers, they fan a little sooner, a little later, because their genes are just different enough that they have different programming. And so there's a wider spectrum, and they do better. They also find that in the genetically diverse multi-father colonies, they're more resistant to bacteria and parasites. They build honeycomb much faster than single-father colonies, and they collect more nectar and pollen.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of months, they had five times the population of a single-father colony. So there's lots of benefits.
A lot of genetic advantage of having multiple partners.
Right.
In this case, just for the queen to have multiple partners.
Right.
In other critters, I guess it works both ways, or the other ways that... monogamy is really not the way to go.
Well, monogamy is unusual.
Yeah.
I didn't prepare material in that, but I have a lot of material in the different books on each type of animal. Are they monogamous? Some bats are monogamous, some are not.
Right.
Some birds of prey we know are monogamous. You've seen eagles, they mate for life. And so we in New York, we have a lot of hawks, a lot of falcons, and we have the famous pale male, which is the
pale male now has a fourth wife, fourth wife,
right.
Only because the others have died.
Right, so he keeps the territory,
yes,
and courts another wife when the one dies, and then keeps producing children in that same territory. So that's not uncommon with some birds. In hummingbirds, I remember in... Arizona, I visited some people who bought a house and had a tiny hummingbird nest on the porch of the house. And they made a video of this, and there's also a book, and I didn't bring the name of it. I'll put it on the website. But that hummingbird comes, that's the female. She comes back every year and mates somewhere and then raises her babies in that nest year after year. It's been about 6 years, and she's still back every year.
Well, I think the message today is, since we're signing off in a minute for this segment, is variety, which is good for your genes and maybe makes your sex life more exciting.
And you can collect more pollen.
And you can collect more pollen if you're a pollen collector. And that was terrific. And we're going to sign off now on this section of our talk on... strategies and reproduction, and it was terrific. And remember. Okay, here we are again, back for our third section talk today on strategy, reproduction, and mating strategies and myth. And we spoke about bees, which were fascinating, the virgin queen. And we spoke about butterflies and some other critters. And my co-host today is Carol Butler, who you've probably heard from before. And she has a terrific background in this. She's a psychotherapist, and she did a lot of training with the Masters and Johnson's Institute, which did a lot of research on sexuality and human sexuality, mostly, I guess.
Right.
And there's an awful lot that we still have to learn about that. So Carol's going to talk about some more strategies and things.
Okay. I thought we would talk about bat genitals.
Ah, bat genitals. Yes, I think I saw... No, I didn't see it on Sesame Street. It must have been a different show, but go ahead.
Okay. Testes size is an interesting area of bat research. It's interesting to me. Most mammals have species that have testes, rather, that are relative to their body size. So larger animals have larger testes, smaller ones have smaller testes. But that is not the case with bats. The size of testes in bats has an unusual range, and the range is not related to the size of the bat. It's related to the amount of sperm that they need to produce. So in bats where multiple males roost with multiple females, regardless of the size of the bat, these bats have the largest testes. In species where there's one male and several females roosting together, the testes size is intermediate. And in species where single males roost with single females, the testes size is smaller. In some bat species, the female stores the sperm for several months after mating. So they mate, but then they hibernate, and they don't start to produce fertilized embryos for months. And in those cases, in those species, the male's testes are also relatively large, presumably because they have to produce a large quantity of sperm so that there's enough viable sperm to survive the storage period.
So the females store it?
Yes.
Okay, so they copulate, and then the female doesn't use the sperm immediately.
Right.
So it's stored away. She
right.
puts it like in the freezer.
That's correct.
In little plastic baggies, labels it John Bat and George Bat,
right.
and those kind of things?
That's correct.
Well, that's a nice way. Okay.
So, and then there's another related study that most of your listeners probably have heard about because it got covered everywhere several years ago when it came out. This is a study done by Scott Pitnick at Syracuse University, and he discovered in species where the females are promiscuous, the males have evolved relatively large testes, but they have relatively small brains. The reason for this, as we understand it, is that brain tissue and sperm cells both require a great deal of metabolic energy to produce and maintain. And so one type of tissue develops at the cost of the other, depending on which one will improve the chances of reproductive success.
That's interesting. So, and I know that you being a female, I think you really enjoyed this. Now, did you learn that from Masters and Johnson?
No.
About humans?
About what are you applying to humans?
Brain size and testing size.
Oh, brain size. Well, that's sort of common knowledge.
That
right?
you learn from life experience, right?
right?
Hmm, I think I need another co-host. I don't know.
But you roped me into that.
This is terrific. So the conjecture is, or the research shows, that it's the same kind of energy
right.
to produce the testes tissues and the brain tissues.
Right. They have very high metabolic costs.
High
so
metabolic
can't have both.
You can't have both.
Right. Okay. So since we're speaking about bat genitals, there's a new study that I just came across about fellatio in bats. Other than among humans, there's very little documentation of oral genital contact. There's some research about juvenile primates called bonobo, which are a species of chimpanzees, actually a threatened species that's found only in the Congo. But it's documented as play behavior.
Mm.
And then there's one female orangutan that somebody wrote about, who somebody observed, who did some genital manipulation of the male, before and after, during copulation. Mm-hmm. But it's just one orangutan.
That was
orangutan.
Just one, right. One observation. So
right.
We don't,
so
yeah.
We wonder about that. One scientist in one of the discussions that I read said that he thinks that one of the reasons this isn't discussed more, or there hasn't been more observation of oral genital contact, is that scientists are uncomfortable with it.
Hmm. You mean discussing it?
Discussing it, yeah.
Oh, right.
So this is one of the advantages of going to Masters and Johnson, because you get over being uncomfortable about these things.
Mm-hmm.
There is some licking of genitals, which is common among animals before and after copulation, which is sometimes to detect whether the female is an estrus. There are different reasons for doing it. So this new research was done in South China on short-nosed fruit bats that are native to Southeast Asia. And there's even a video online. You may need to see this video. The researchers used infrared video monitors to record the behavior of caged pairs of bats. Excuse me. They observed 20 pairs of bats mating and genital copulation. And in 14 out of 20 matings, the females performed fellatio on the males. And here's the way they describe it. After the male mounted the female from behind, now remember, they're both hanging from their feet.
Upside down.
Mm. The male mounted the female from behind and penetrated her. She then bent over, which in this case means bending forward and up, and began licking the shaft of his penis. While the male was inside her, they don't withdraw while this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
The longer the female licked, the longer the copulation lasted.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the male was enjoying it,
right.
Because
right.
Of the action of the female.
Right.
That's
right.
Okay.
So
right.
I thought you were going to ask me how long did it last.
Well, I was going to get to that.
when the female was licking the male, it lasted twice. The copulation lasted twice as long, which is not that long, 4 minutes,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to half of that on average, in the couples where there was no licking. And mm-hmm. and interestingly, where there was no licking, sometimes the mating was forced. Male, the females were unwilling, and the males sort of chased them down. And they speculate that may be why the sex act was different.
Uh-huh.
So then we have the same question. What is the evolutionary purpose of this behavior? And there are several hypotheses about it. It certainly seems to help maintain the male's erection. The saliva increases lubrication. And prolonged intercourse probably facilitates sperm transport. Also, the female is being active. So we would...
She's participating.
Right. We'd mm-hmm. suspect that the behavior stimulates her as well. They suggest maybe it stimulates the pituitary, but probably in some way increases the likelihood of fertilization because of her activity.
Mm.
We also know that saliva has antibacterial, antifungal, antichlamydial, and antiviral properties, so that the licking may well be protective as well. And again, we see that in many animals after copulation.
Mm.
They did a study. I don't know what kind of animal they did it on or how they did it. It would be interesting to know that. But the result was that when there was genital licking, there were fewer sexually transmitted diseases.
Of bats.
I don't know what animal it was.
Right. Okay, I'm just still trying to visualize the position of the bats doing this thing.
Watch the video.
Okay, so that was terrific, and I won't touch this topic right now.
We'll just
sign off. But that was a terrific thing, and I'm sure Jack, our engineer, really enjoyed that. We did this section for him because he's a young guy, so he should know all these things. Okay. So we're going to sign off today, and our sponsor for this segment was Fairway Market, which is a terrific market, and I think they're popping up all over the place. And remember, this is a Heritage Radio Network, and the program is The Naturalist, and my co-host today was Carol Butler.
Thank you for inviting me back.
It was a lot of fun. We'll have to do it again, Carol.
Okay.
Signing off.